Thank you for tuning in to Voices for Freedom, an anti-human trafficking podcast. We want to acknowledge that the content we discuss can be emotionally challenging and may evoke strong reactions. The stories we share often delve into tough subjects related to human trafficking, which may be difficult for some listeners to hear. Our goal is to raise awareness and promote understanding of the complexities surrounding human trafficking. Listener discretion is advised. Coming up on Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast.
We looked at police reports that were pending, and we found one where it involved a father who locked up his three children in a 10 by 10 wooden room. These kids were fed through the crack of the door that he would pass food through them. And for 6 months, they were locked in that room. We were able to rescue them as well. So if we had not acted, there would have been 9 children that would never have been rescued.
Welcome to Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast brought to you by Our Rescue. I'm Matt Osborne, Global Ambassador for Operations and Education. My co-host Jessica Mass and I have really enjoyed this weekly podcast series where we focus on the depth and breadth of what we do in Our Rescue, focusing on international operations, domestic operations, our canine program, survivor care, our new leadership, the new direction. We have many more episodes to come. What I'm so excited about today is we get to focus back on international operations and introduce you to one of the amazing individuals on the front line in this fight. We are going to go all the way down south to Ecuador. Let me see here if the technology is working. We are joined by Albert de la Huerta, our regional operations director for Latin America. Albert, can you hear me? How are you today?
Hey, Matt, how are you? I can hear you perfectly, and thank you for having me.
Well, thank you very much. I've gotten to know you a little bit. I see the operational tempo that your teams have almost every day, the support you're providing to so many countries. So thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to appear on Voices for Freedom. You have had a very interesting career before you got to Our Rescue with government, law enforcement. Maybe take time to share a little bit with our audience how you first came to work these cases of child exploitation and human trafficking.
Well, my path to where I am now was a windy one, and it was not planned. I was actually going through university for my MBA, and I never planned on being in law enforcement. And because someone offered me a job with the cruise line while I was going to school, I was able to meet an FBI agent who offered me the job. And I decided then to try it. And 30 years later, here I am. I was a special agent with U.S. Customs. I started in 1993. In 2003, they merged Customs into Department of Homeland Security, Homeland Security Investigations, where I worked for another 20 years. We did all types of investigations, from narcotics trafficking to arms trafficking, money laundering, human trafficking, child exploitation. So we had a very wide variety of investigations. My last 4 years, I was lucky enough. And that's part of where my path was unexpected, because my kids had grown up. My opportunity to come to Ecuador came open, and I decided to take the chance on it. And I came to Quito, and I was the attaché here for 3 years until I retired.
Was there an emblematic case? Do you remember the first case you worked? Was it before you got to Ecuador as attaché? Obviously, Homeland Security investigations are amazing in what they do. That's a more recent iteration, isn't it? HSI, you know, of the ICE and the DHS. But talk us a little bit about that, and maybe if there's a case that you remember from your government career dealing with human trafficking.
One of the strongest cases I had in Miami involved a bar that was forcing several women to have sex for money, and that they were locked in. They would sleep in the bar, and we were able to conduct a rescue and arrest them. When I arrived in Quito, the office here was 100% focused on narcotic smuggling, and it bothered me a bit because we did so much more. So I changed the focus of the office immediately. I started making contacts with the Ecuadorian National Police, with the human trafficking units, with the child pornography units. And I've really started to focus on that. And that is the windy way how I got to OUR, because that's when I got introduced to OUR and I started working very closely with them.
How did you first hear about Our Rescue? How did you know that this is what you wanted to do? Because I'll just say again to you and to so many, and we just have so many amazing women and men in our organization who, for them, this is their second career. They were former government, they were former prosecutors, former law enforcement, former military, across the board experts in business. These men and women could really do anything with that second stage of their career, and yet they choose to work for Our Rescue. What was it about our organization, how you heard about us, how you first started again with this case that we'll discuss, to give again our audience a little bit of an idea of how you went from U.S. federal government attaché for Homeland Security investigations in the embassy in Quito, Ecuador, to now in, you know, helping lead our operations in Latin America?
I heard about OUR. They were working closely with the attaché office in Bogota, Colombia. So it brought interest to me. I heard really good things about the organization. Luckily, I knew the regional director personally from OUR over South America. I contacted him. At that point, there was no OUR presence in Ecuador at all. So I was able to make contact and invited him to come. I made introductions with the Ecuadorian National Police, and we started working together.
And as you know, I'll set the scene a little bit for this first part of the operation. This was an operation against a suspected pedophile ring from the Netherlands. I think we could probably even take that suspected off of there because they had been convicted and charged in the Netherlands of wanting to start a political party that essentially legalized sex between adults and children. And we had gotten information that there was one member of this ring in Mexico. And we have footage of this working very closely with Mexico authorities. And this individual, he's very tall and he had his red spiky hair the day of his arrest. And he was, again, admitting to us that he was, you know, hiding out in Mexico because he could get away with these terrible crimes that he couldn't maybe in the Netherlands because they were looking for him. Well, through some investigations with this case and this individual, we got leads that he had been down with two of his other Dutch buddies in Ecuador, very close to home in a small town that you can discuss in a minute. But you had then these two individuals and a few others where it's a fascinating dynamic, and I think maybe our audience doesn't realize how prevalent this is around the world, where Westerners mostly, pedophiles set up in rural areas, third world countries, where they buy off the local population through money or giving them food, TV sets, or through force, fraud, coercion, kind of have sway over a town where then they're able to exploit their children. So once we found this network had moved down to a small town in Ecuador, can you take over of what you were working on, again, always with Ecuadorian authorities? And then we'll end that segment, and we'll end the next segment then with sort of the beyond, the good that you've done there and focus on your region. But this was a really emblematic case for us because it was multinational, multi-jurisdictional, true international, and again, a group of pet predators who had already been convicted in their countries, had fled, and now, again, not to steal the thunder, but two of them in your country have been convicted for the crimes they were committing in Ecuador.
To me, it was an interesting investigation because I saw it first from the law enforcement HSI perspective, and then I dealt with it as OUR. First, OUR did an excellent job. Without those leads, we would never have known about that group in Canoa. As soon as we got the information, I got the Ecuadorian National Police. We started doing the surveillances on the hotel. As you said, it was a hotel that was offering child sex tourism. They were using different chat groups and social media to advertise what they were doing. And when we were doing surveillance, we did it for maybe 2 weeks. We observed lots of children going in and out of that hotel on a daily basis. What the two Dutch citizens were doing was offering free lunch to the kids in Canoa, taking advantage of their vulnerability and how poor they were, that they were desperate for food. So they would go into the hotel. When they were inside the hotel, they would drug the kids, and then they would sell them basically for the tourists that were there staying at the hotel. And we did the arrests. There were only a few children there, basically for one family.
But also because it was late at night, right? Ecuadorian authorities go in, because we don't have arrest authority in our rescue. This was all at their behest, their request for our support. And then you're right, one of the suspects, Leslie, was there. His partner, Martine, was not there. And there was, I think, what, one or two children? However, describe that place. I mean, again, I've only seen it on video. There were games there, maybe a swimming pool, right? Some sort of Xbox or something. Talk to us a little bit about what they found inside.
They were very selective about their location, first of all. The hotel was literally across the street from a children's park. As you said, they enticed the children with Xbox. They played video games there. They gave free food, so it was very welcoming to the children. These children were drugged, and they would leave afterwards and not know what happened to them. Sometimes they were bleeding. Sometimes they were in pain, and they didn't know what happened.
Yeah, and just unbelievable. Some of the footage, some of the interviews with the survivors, the little boys on scene, and I remember one boy would say, with his father there, you know, telling authorities, nothing happened, nothing happened. And then the boy's father put his hand on his shoulder, right? It's okay, you can tell. And then he starts crying and then talks about, yes, having to take baths and having to be there. And then, as you mentioned, and so just absolutely disgusting. But Leslie and Martine were arrested, and they were tried, and they were convicted and sentenced. You were spearheading the aftercare, and obviously aftercare, survivor care is so challenging. But as we wrap up this segment, maybe a minute on sort of what you're most satisfied with in terms of this operation from the beginning to the end. And then if that was sort of what then made you decide, look, I'm going in our rescue full time now, and there's so much promise in South America that we'll then handle in the next segment of this podcast.
Yeah, I wanted to touch a point that you made about the vulnerability and about the parents many times knowing what was happening. And in this case, this is exactly what was happening. These parents were aware of what was happening. They were taking money from the two Dutch citizens, and none of them came forward and did a complaint or were willing to testify at trial. So we technically were not able to charge them for sex tourism. Fortunately or unfortunately, we were able to locate child sexual abuse material, CSAM, where they were on their phones. So that's technically what they were charged for and sentenced for. Right. If we didn't find those pictures, they would still be operating in that hotel.
And that's what happens so often, isn't it, in these trafficking situations? I mean, you have a victim who understandably doesn't want to testify against her trafficker, her victimizer, because through force, fraud, coercion, fear. So you're right. These two would have gotten off scot-free if not for the digital forensic support that our rescue provided. Geraldine went down, you know, Dan went down. We had other people there on site. And that's what really got them, the child sex abuse material. That's why we have these dogs, obviously, that you know, are able to find this. And I'm just very grateful for you, for your team. We're under no illusions, right, that other Westerners have, you know, are operating and exploiting in other towns. But we're going to continue to work, aren't we? We're going to continue to track down a lot of these predators in these areas, because this is happening so often and too few people realize what the dynamic is overseas.
And unfortunately, like the Canoa case shows, most of the time it's desperate parents that are doing it themselves or selling their children. So if we're not the ones that are fighting for it, these kids have no chance at all. They'll continue being sexually exploited.
Exactly. Well, grateful for that help and glad you're now on full time with us. When we come back in the next segment, I'd love for you to share maybe one or two of the most detailed operations that you've done in your region. Again, just to give a little bit of the scope of this. But we're going to take a short break now, so please don't go anywhere. A message from our sponsors, but thank you so much for joining us on Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast brought to you by Our Rescue. Big thanks to this week's sponsor, the Our Rescue Store, for supporting the podcast. The Our Rescue Store is committed to responsibly sourcing products that ignite conversations about human trafficking, raising awareness and contributing to the movement against it. With more than enough colors, designs, and items to choose from, there's definitely something for you. Find something you'll be proud to own and be an advocate for change. Visit store.ourrescue.org and use the promo code VOICES10 for 10% off your purchase. That's VOICES10 on store.ourrescue.org. And welcome back to Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast brought to you by Our Rescue. We've been talking to our regional operations director for Latin America, Albert de la Huerta, coming to us from Ecuador. We'll go back down south now through the magic of technology to Ecuador. Albert, you have, I think, one of the largest regions under your command, so to speak, under your leadership, at least in terms of the number of countries. Share with us just a few of the countries with whom we're working the closest, and then perhaps one or two operations, cases that you think really show the challenges, but also the opportunities that come from Our Rescue to support the law enforcement in South America, in Latin America writ large.
The region covers all of Latin America, so we start with Mexico. We have Dominican Republic in the Caribbean. We have a presence in Panama. We have physical presence in South America, in Ecuador, Peru, Argentina, and Colombia. We cover all the other countries on a case-by-case basis, but those are the main countries with which we work.
And just to stress, too, we are not a vigilante organization. We go through the front door. We don't go in at all. Each of these cases or each of these countries in which we're working are always at the express request and invitation of these governments.
That's correct. And most of these countries are poor. They don't have a lot of funds for their police. And much of this work would never happen without our support.
You know, doing the show prep with you earlier this week was just, you blew my mind with that case in the Amazon. And tell us a little bit about that. And again, you're a humble hero, would never talk about the dangers your team faces. But when you think about the Amazon, when you think about the rainforest, when you think about just the size of the continent, walk us through this case sort of from beginning to end in terms of the highlights, because this one I'm still kind of reeling, thinking about how daring it was in a lot of ways, but how necessary to reach exploited children and adults who no one was looking for them. I mean, that's just the way it is. It's true. No one was looking for them because of the isolation and where they were.
I think it shows that OUR is willing to travel to the most remote areas in the world to rescue children. So it was a beautiful case in that sense. We work closely with Ecuadorian National Police. They asked us for assistance with funding a trip deep into the Amazon. So, of course, I assisted with that. I traveled along, as well as a survivor trail came along with us. It was very long and arduous. It was a 8-hour drive the first night. Then we drove another 6 hours into the Amazon by car. Then we had to rent 8 canoes for 40 people to go to 5 hours more by canoe into a very remote village.
Did you have at least experienced guides or anything to take you through? I mean, I'm thinking piranhas. I'm thinking, you know, all sorts of things when you're going down these just canoes.
We did. We actually had to take a tribal leader because you can't enter these tribal areas. Some of them will kill you, but they operate with their own laws. It's very different. They fall under Ecuadorian law, but they have their own tribal laws. So we literally had to ask for permission to enter. Without the tribal leaders, we wouldn't have been able to get in. After the long drive, when we arrived there, it was interesting because we had a meeting with the tribal chiefs, and we had to show the judge's order. We had to ask for permission. That took about a half hour. It's an interesting process. It was like a legal hearing.
Two questions from that. First of all, how did Ecuadorian National Police get the intelligence about the trafficking and exploitation in this remote of an area? And secondly, did tribal leaders even recognize the long arm of the law, recognize judicial authorities in Quito, the capital of Ecuador? Because I can imagine some areas they say, heck no, you're not coming in, stay out. This isn't your area. We run this area.
To answer your second question first, yes, you definitely, they have their own laws. We have authority. They respect Ecuadorian law, but they have their own. But when it's something like this serious, they'll honor it. It was just a matter of showing the judge's order, and then they let us on. Unfortunately, by that time, the kids had been told to hide. It took us several hours to find them.
What was the what did you expect when you got there? What was the intelligence in terms of, was this forced labor? Was this sexual exploitation? Who were the perpetrators? What kind of intelligence did you get from Ecuadorian National Police? Or I should say, what intelligence did they get from this region?
We rescued four children. The mother would be hit by her husband, and eventually she left them. The tribe kicked her out, and so she went to a different city, and that's where she did a police complaint. And fortunately, it reached Quito, where I was able to influence them to go. We went there, and once we got permission, it took us a while to get to find the kids. The kids had been lied to. They had told them that the mother left the father for a different husband. So when we found them, they didn't want to go with her. So that was a problem. Fortunately, she was able to talk to them and convince them to come. But the whole process in the village took over 2 hours to locate them and get them.
So, and this is after you said the multi-hours in the canoe and all of that and the difficult to get everybody there. And again, without our rescue funds, there just quite simply would have been no way the Ecuadorian authorities would have had the funding to get to this area, correct?
Absolutely, no way. They depend on us greatly for our resources, both training and financial. When I got here, they didn't have any platforms, so we had to get them training on the different platforms. And now our goal is to try to get them self-sustained, you know, where they don't depend on us to work these cases.
Was the father himself the one abusing the kids? Was he selling the kids around the village? How was he exploiting them sexually?
It's a very different culture with the indigenous tribes here. It's almost accepted that the father has sex with their children. So the father and his two brothers were violating all four children. And you're talking a 14-year-old daughter already had a baby with her father. And the baby's not even a year old. And the youngest sibling was like 4 years old. So these kids have lived their entire lives with sexual abuse.
Wow. How is survivor care handled in such a rural area, remote, even dangerous areas, especially when, as you just said, the father and tribal leaders were absolutely involved, aware of this, likely protecting it? Talk about the survivor care in this case for those four and how you and your region try to get the survivor care even into the most remote, desolate, and dangerous areas.
Yeah, we traveled first in a big group. We took a lot of the SWAT team members because we anticipated a problem. Like, we were out there in the middle of nowhere. If they turned on us, like, there's nothing you could do. You either get back in the room and run or you fight. Luckily, that didn't happen. But we went prepared with a lot of armed officers. We also took our survivor care so they could take the softer approach with the survivors. Jocelyn did a great job. It wasn't an easy operation. I'm old, so my back was killing me in the canoe ride.
I can't even imagine.
Jocelyn had arranged for a shelter in Macas, which is the city where we went to at a base. And the kids were able to go straight into the shelter. We seeked medical care for them. And she supported them with psychological care and continues to do so. This was only, I don't think it was even 2 months ago.
It's amazing what you were able to do in this case to get survivor care deployed and effective in such a remote area. But I understand that the operation and the good that you did didn't stop there, correct?
Correct. I wanted to take advantage of being in such a remote area. And when we were in Macas, Ecuador, we looked at police reports that were pending. And we found one where it involved a father who locked up his three children in a 10 by 10 wooden room outdoors. It's a hot area. They didn't have air conditioning. These poor children were not allowed to get out. They were treated worse than dogs. Dogs are at least walked. These kids were fed through the crack of the door that he would pass food through them. And for 6 months, they were locked in that room. We were able to rescue them as well. So if we had not acted, there would have been 9 children that would never have been rescued.
I mean, the things that humans do to other humans, it's just utterly disgusting. And the fact that you were able to do this, you know, there are amazing groups out there fighting human trafficking, child exploitation, and we partner with them, we support them. I really think that one of the things our rescue does, again, is supporting law enforcement to help them go look for people for whom no one is looking. And there's no doubt that these kids you're talking about fall in that category.
Yes, it's, you see the worst of humanity, but if you focus on the rescue, it makes it really fulfilling, this job.
That's what we always talk about, isn't it? How amazing it is. The real heroes in this, obviously the survivors, but when you look at the law enforcement side, those who are not making much money, certainly by U.S. and Western standards, who are obviously getting a lot of temptation from the cartels and organized crime to, you know, to turn and to support them. The fact that these law enforcement officers, men and women on the ground, would do all they can to rescue children, to rescue adults, to fight trafficking. And as you said, the worst of humanity you see on the trafficking side, but it is really a breath of fresh air, I imagine, to work with great individuals in Ecuador and all of those countries you just named.
Yes, my experience with law enforcement in the region is excellent. They all want to do their jobs. They all want to rescue. They just don't have the resources to do it. Like, they literally will sometimes ask me for money for fuel, because they can't even do surveillance. It's that bad in some of these areas.
And that's why oftentimes with this Voices for Freedom podcast, we do put out a call to action to go to ourrescue.org and donate. And you might not think $5 a month makes a difference, $25 a month. How much, honestly, would just putting some gas in a motorcycle of a cop and allow him or her to go different places to actually work these cases? We're not talking a lot of money, are we?
No, we're not. On this trip, we spent less than $2,000 and we rescued 9 children.
Absolutely. And think about how many people paying the $5 a month, $25 a month. So we do have a little bit of time in this segment. Let's turn real quick for a wider problem that you're seeing in terms of trafficking trends in your region run by gangs, criminal gangs entrenched in society in Latin America, obviously a lot coming up into the United States as well. Maybe take a few minutes and talk to us about the fight your team is taking to the gangs, always again behind supporting law enforcement. But what are you seeing down there in terms of gang involvement in child sexual exploitation and human trafficking?
I think that organized crimes or these gangs are discovering that there's a lot of money to be made in human trafficking. So they're expanding from narcotics smuggling, and they're really entrenched now in human trafficking. One big example is a Venezuelan-based gang called Tren de Aragua. It began maybe in 2010 in a jail in Aragua, Venezuela. They've expanded. They have presence probably in every country in South America. Wow. And they've even recently been found to be in the U.S. I think they murdered a police officer recently.
Yeah, that's so been in the news too.
Yeah, they have expanded greatly. These people are bad people. It's terrible the way they treat the girls. They beat them. We've seen them dismembered. We've seen grave sites where they've dug up several victims. They rape them. They lock them up in rooms and don't let them out. It's a bad trend.
You know, think back to your early government career. And again, when I was with the CIA, U.S. Department of State, working closely with the Drug Enforcement Administration in Mexico, there used to be honor among thieves in a little way, you know, to say something, where the drug cartels and others would just focus on getting their product to the north and they'd want to get their guns coming from the U.S. and money coming from the U.S. They wouldn't really traffic human beings, maybe adults, but certainly not children. That really has changed, hasn't it, with these smaller gangs who have then become powerful, like El Tren de Aragua that you're mentioning. Are you seeing that more and more, that these gangs realize, and again, as you just said, how lucrative this is when you sell a human being over and over again? And unfortunately, now it has absolutely spread to almost every criminal organization, I would say, in Latin America.
Yes, and there's Ecuadorian gangs. There's Los Tiguerones. They have a very big presence in Peru, as well as Tren de Aragua. They control several sections of the city of Lima, and it's all human trafficking. They're forcing on the southern border of Ecuador to Peru. Girls on a daily basis are funneling out to Peru.
Well, I hope your team and you stay safe for sure, because these gangs, and they've got the money now that they're bringing in, and it's easy to buy off and corrupt local, state, even federal law enforcement in these countries. What steps do you take with your Our Rescue team to make sure that they don't walk in any of these traps when they are supporting law enforcement on some of these operations?
Well, even the police are out armed. These gangs are right. Very heavily armed.
Outgunned, outmanned, yeah.
Yep, they do a lot of crimes, not only human trafficking, but extortion and sequester people, they kidnap people. So it's a dangerous fight for the police. I feel for them. They have a really big problem on their hands. When we approach an operation, we have no law enforcement authorization. We right. are there to support. We basically sit back and watch them enter. Once they cleared it, then we go ahead and go in and try to help out.
Right. Well, again, just with the geographical size of your region and all the countries, but they are interested in our support. They know we come in and we provide the funding, training, tools, technology behind the scenes. We're going to pivot now for the final segment, talk a little bit about your future for the organization in Latin America, what you're doing. But anything you want to tie up on any of those cases on the Amazon or the gangs, thank you for sharing that much detail to really take our audience behind the scenes to just see how difficult and dangerous these operations are, but how absolutely vital they are to go and find these individuals who have unfortunately just fallen off the radar.
I think it is very important for people to know that these countries depend on our support. These investigations, I can't say enough, they would not be done without OUR's support. Absolutely not. The police love us. They call me almost on a daily basis to coordinate cases. We're involved hand in hand. We help them plan operations, and it's a really good working relationship.
Yeah, I've seen it firsthand. It is incredible. Albert, I know it's getting late there, but hopefully you can stay with us for one more segment, right? All right, perfect. Don't go anywhere. And you please don't go anywhere either. You are listening to Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast brought to you by Our Rescue. We'll be right back. I want to thank today's sponsor, the Our Rescue Store, for supporting this podcast. Did you know the Our Rescue Store features survivor-made items? In this critical fight, they serve as symbols of hope. By choosing to purchase one of these beautifully handcrafted items, you'll impact the healing journey of survivors and help them reclaim their lives in the process. We encourage you to shop survivor-made items on the Our Rescue Store website. It might only be a few dollars to you, but it makes a world of difference to them. And in case you need any extra motivation, use promo code VOICES10 for 10% off your purchase at store.ourrescue.org. That's VOICES10 at store.ourrescue.org. Welcome back to Voices for Freedom, an anti-trafficking podcast brought to you by Our Rescue. I'm Matt Osborne, Our Rescue Global Ambassador for Operations and Education. And we have been talking to our regional director for operations in Latin America, Albert de la Huerta, many years with the United States government, law enforcement at various levels, and now heading up our operational support. Let's go back down to Ecuador. We appreciate Albert staying up with us late here. In the last segment, again, the detail you shared about the operational support we provided in the Amazon region, rescuing the 9 kids for whom no one was looking, then talking about the gangs. let's use this last segment to talk about the future, the transition, the new Our Rescue, where it's so much more, you know, the behind the scenes, as I mentioned earlier, funding, training, tools, technology, our canine program, online, cyber, digital forensics, really stepping up the battle against child exploitation, human trafficking. But we will continue from time to time to do these hands-on operational support or provide the hands-on operational support to law enforcement when they request it. So, Albert, talk to us about your vision for the region now as you fully take the reins in Latin America, as you think about what our donors can help you and your teams accomplish, as we look to doing all we can to be this force multiplier, to do exactly what law enforcement wants, provided they're doing the right things to focus on the rescue, the arrest, the survivor care, the education, the outreach, which I know you and I have talked about, you think is a big topic as well.
This region is a very poor region. It's not from a lack of wanting. These officers all are excellent, and they really want to help. They just don't have the resources. So we have to focus on training, first of all. They need to know how to work child sexual abuse material cases. We need to get them access to the different platforms that are used by law enforcement. I mean, just today I visited the cyber crimes unit for the Ecuadorian National Police. And you're talking, they're the cyber crimes unit. You would think they would have the best computers. Their computers are literally 15 years old. Like, it's a really bad situation that you can't run these platforms off those old computers. So there's a very big need for funding the purchase of equipment. I mean, we wouldn't get them cars, but the cars, they drove me in one of the operations where I got into the car. It was like a 1990 Nissan Sentra with over 300,000 miles on it. They have really old cars, really old equipment. The officers purchased their own ammo.
They have to pay out of their own pocket. So it'd be like an FBI agent, the equivalent of an FBI special agent having to pay for his or her own ammo out of their own pocket.
Correct. So they never even qualify. They don't train because that's coming out of pocket for them to buy their own rounds for training. So it's that level of need. And second, we need to continue the support financially for these operations. 90% of these operations are in remote areas. They're in islands, they're in the Amazon, they're in, you know, you're talking about Peru, the Amazon crosses many of these countries. So it requires a lot of resources to be able to go in there. I haven't even talked about the northern border with Colombia. That's all controlled by FARC. So they're outgunned. They have a big issue and they need our support 100%.
You talk about training, and that's such a big thing that we try to facilitate through training. What types of training is most of need? And when you think about prices, and this can just be ballpark, but because again, if we are able to raise $5,000, $10,000, maybe even a little bit more, what type of training could we provide not only in Ecuador, but in other countries in your region? And what do you think they would be able to do with that in the near and medium term?
They need everything. I am asked on a daily basis for NCMEC training, the National
Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Yeah, NCMEC, that's right.
They ask for Child Protective System, which is a platform for CSAM cases. They ask for training on how to handle victims. They need training in everything, tactical. I'm in awe of their lack of tactics. Like they don't control their environment well. Like it's a dangerous environment, and they really need to be taught better tactics, because it's going to be a dangerous situation for them, especially when dealing with gangs. And not only on the equipment and the digital side, they also need training with survivor care. They also need help with shelters. Their shelters are very bare. They provide the bare minimum. Thank God for survivor care. They provide a lot of assistance to these shelters. They buy women's products that they don't have money for. They buy very basic things that don't cost a lot of money, but go a long way with helping these women's shelters. You just can't stop. They need money for everything, basically.
You know, sometimes we have our operational, you know, operations directors and others come on this show, those who are at the forefront of this fight, who are in this dark, kind of deep world. I mean, you had to go to that town in the Amazon. I'm sure that still haunts you in a lot of ways, thinking about those kids being abused by the father and uncle and, you know, other tribal leaders. The other kids in the shack where they're being fed through the wall. What is it that keeps you going? What is your why, as we always say, for leading out here at Our Rescue, whether it's what you learned in the government and now to our nonprofit? Because, again, some people would just go into a fetal position and say, I can't deal with the worst of humanity, as you mentioned. What is it, Albert, that keeps you going every single day?
I have never been more fulfilled in my life, including my 30 years in law enforcement. When you're in law enforcement, especially doing like narcotics investigations, you can seize tons and tons of cocaine, but it never stops. Like, you have zero effect. And with OUR, I'm able to see what my work results in. I see the faces of the survivors. I see the smiles and the children. It's a beautiful thing. I mean, I see the worst in humanity, but I choose to focus on the beauty of the rescues and how we help every day.
So what's next for your team and you? Obviously, we don't want specific countries, regions, anything that would give it away. Tell us in general terms what kind of operational support you imagine we'll be providing in, let's say, the next week or two.
Well, there's several cases. There's one involving a pediatrician who's violating children. So imagine, he must be seeing 10 children a day at least. Imagine the amount of victims that are there, and we have to stop him because of his position. So that's going to be the next operation we work on.
Well, that's absolutely vital to get that type of predator off the streets. I mean, those who would prey on kids, who go where the kids are. We see too many times in schools and in churches, youth leaders, this pediatrician, as we talked about in an earlier segment on this show, those Dutch pedophiles who went to a town that had a lot of vulnerable children to exploit them. I wish your team well for sure on that. And then is there anything else on the radar or any particular initiative that you're thinking about here as we start to get to summer? Because tourist season, you have a lot of great tourist spots in your countries where Westerners go, Americans and others. And as you know, it's just this small percentage of men who would do it. But when you bring a lot of men and men with means, there's going to be exploitation. And so I imagine that our law enforcement partners down there are gearing up for the summer tourist season, not in a good way. Hey, we love having tourists here, but we imagine there's going to be a lot more sexual exploitation.
Yes, definitely. There are a lot of tourist locations, especially in Ecuador, and child sex tourism is rampant. They force a lot of young girls to service the crew on several ships. There's a lot of ship movement from Ecuador, and a lot of U.S. citizens and other country citizens that come here just for child sex tourism.
Maybe give you the final word, Albert. What would you say to those listening and watching now who might say, well, think to themselves, you know, they think, why would I donate to Our Rescue, not any of these other organizations? What is it about our organization that you think can give people confidence that their donations will be going directly to this fight, empowering the men and women on the front lines in your region, let's just say, since we have you on the show today?
I think these countries, even $100 makes a difference. Like I said, I pay for fuel and it's $50, and it's like giving them an opportunity to work surveillance on these cases. Like, you literally don't need a lot of money to help and make these child exploitation cases go.
Yeah, I love it. And $100, right? Or 20 people giving $5, or you give $5 a month, $25 a month. This Voices for Freedom podcast, obviously, it's not a fundraiser. It's for mission awareness and education, but it's so important to know why we do this and why we direct people to OurRescue.org. Albert, we thank you, sir. We are praying for you. We're wishing success to your team and you. Please keep up the good work, and we will keep our fingers crossed that this pediatrician will go down, be arrested, that there will be able to find the kids who he was exploiting and is exploiting, And just know that you do have so many people here and around the world supporting your team. So thank you, sir. We are just so grateful for all you do every single day.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate it. It was great.
Thank you very much. And mostly thank you for watching and supporting Our Rescue. Thank you for viewing and listening to this episode of Voices for Freedom. We need you to like this podcast. We need you to click like. We need you to share, to support, to get this out to as many people as possible. Each week, we interview experts, both from our team and other organizations. It's kind of unheard of that one nonprofit in the anti-human trafficking space would prop up another, would support another. That's what we do. Thank you so much for watching Voices for Freedom. Join us next week for another episode. We'll see you then.
Thanks for listening. Did you enjoy this episode? If so, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have ideas for future episodes, email us at voicesforfreedom@ourrescue.org. Lastly, we encourage you to join the fight. Make a difference today by donating at ourrescue.org or text podcast to 75004. Again, that number is 75004.
Join me for the next episode of Voices for Freedom when I have the privilege of interviewing John DiGirolamo, critically acclaimed author of It's Not About the Sex, True Stories of Human Trafficking from a Law Enforcement Officer, Survivor, Brothel Madam, and Advocate. John will tell us how we're going to bust the myths of human trafficking and expose the truths and how we can fight it. Join us next time.